Today, my guest is the president and the CEO of the Houston Food Bank, a nonprofit organization that feeds the hungry by seeking food donations and distributing them to a network of 1,500 community partners. Founded in 1982, the organization helps over 800,000 people every year. In this episode, we talk about food insecurity and how to manage one of America's largest food banks. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest, Brian Green. Brian, how are you? What have you been up to?
Well, of course, we're entering the holiday season, so there's lots of people doing events and everything. The reality in our work is hunger is a year-round issue. It's not a holiday issue, but you do your best you can while people are most interested in helping. So we're doing a lot of events. We're very busy trying to win resources that hopefully will help us through the rest of the year as well.
How did you get involved with the food bank? I believe before Houston, you were in New Orleans, correct?
Yeah, I've actually been doing this for 30 years now. Originally, I was a doctoral student in the economics program at University of Tennessee, and I wanted to take a leave of absence to do a Peace Corps type stint. But I wanted to, just do something, any job in hunger or homelessness, to feel like, okay, I was kind of doing my do-gooder time, but also hoping to come up with ideas for a dissertation. And I started with the food bank there in Knoxville, and I just absolutely fell in love with the work. And I just never wanted to stop, so I never did finish that program, but I've kept going with this.
I had the opportunity to visit your facility not long ago, and I was very impressed, not only by the size, but how organized and how everything's run. It's very much run like a business. So give us a glimpse and let us know more about the day-to-day operations of the Houston Food Bank.
Well, thank you very much. That was a kind thing to say, and that's actually a lot more difficult than you might guess. Most of our labor is done by volunteers, so you've got people who could be 100 people on a slow day. It could be 1,000 on a very busy day, and they're just coming in all different walks of life, and we're trying to organize them into teams and make sure that they have everything that they need, the training, all the resources to do whatever tasks that they're working on. And so it is it's a tough dance every day, all the time. And it's amazing what the team is able to put together. And so we've got all these food flows coming in literally from all parts of the country. Most of what we get is surplus food from the food industry. And a lot of that requires some sort of work. There's reasons why it was donated. And so we got to take care of whatever problems we have, and then work with the different 1,500 different organizations that we distribute to in the greater Houston area, and run our fleet. We run about 60 trucks per day, tractor trailers, bobtail trucks, to do the distribution so that people get what they want, and then run some of the other interesting programs that we do, because we're already doing a logistics business, really, and just touching the lives of 800,000 people. So we try and find ways that we can do better. So, for instance, we made a very large commercial kitchen here, and so we make hot meals for about 100 after-school programs and daycares per day. It's about 4,500 meals that we produce and unitize hot meals and then distribute those out. We have programs like our SNAP outreach, where we get help families that were already they're visiting the pantry. So we're saying, well, is there a more sustainable way that can provide better help for you? And so we help families get signed up for SNAP. We also do things like try and win resources for teachers in low-income schools. So we have a program we call Teachers Aid, where we provide school supplies that we were able to collect as surplus from companies like, Office Depot, where it's stuff that's coming out of their distribution center that for whatever reason they weren't able to sell. And so we have, we set up like little, four free stores for the teachers. And there's just so many different initiatives that we're able to do because Houston was very generous and, giving us a great facility and a lot of great resources. And so many people are willing to volunteer. And our job is to kind of just try and put it all together and make it work.
So for the last 30 years that you have been doing this, have you seen any improvement regarding food insecurity in America?
Well, that's been part of what our unfortunate realization is the problem hasn't gotten better. When I first started 30 years ago, it was generally our assumption. This was in the early days of food banking. That's why, even though I was coming straight out of college, the food bank in Knoxville hired me there as the executive director because they didn't know any better that, you know, this needs to be bigger than that. But anyway, it, you know, worked out well, and we grew tremendously, and we've been able to do so much more. But the thinking was that if you look at how much hunger there was in America, and you look at how much wasted food there is, and I'm not talking about table waste, but I'm talking about the large scale stuff, you know, at the farm, at the manufacturer, at the distribution center, at the supermarket. And if we could just collect that and channel it through the charities and the churches that want to help, well, shoot, you could, you know, there was more surplus food than there was hunger. So if you put the two together, you wouldn't have hunger. And that was our operating assumption in the early days. And we really grew to the point where theoretically we would have filled that gap, but it didn't work. And the reasons why it didn't work, one of them is that we were naive, I think, in assuming that hunger could be treated as an isolated thing, that you could just, so long as we help someone with food, they're going to have enough food. But the reality is they're struggling to pay their rent. They're struggling to pay their utility bills. They're struggling with emergency expenses. And so a lot of times what we're really doing is we're helping them pay the rent. And also we were naive in our understanding that we just assumed that, you know, hunger was just, if you have enough food, you're not hungry. And food insecurity is actually the larger problem, where most of the time what families are actually doing is making nutritional compromises to get by. So thinking of it as just sort of binary, so as long as we got them any old food, then they're not hungry, therefore we win. That was naive. But then at the same time, over the course of the last 30 years, the nature of our economy has changed. There is so much more of a problem of low-wage employment. When I started, I can confidently say that the vast majority of the people that we serve, what we were dealing with was an unemployment issue. The people we were serving were either temporary or might be long-term unemployment. Now, the majority of people we're serving, they have jobs. According to the Census Bureau, 2/3 of the food insecure households have an adult with a full-time job now. Our problem is the amount of the number of those jobs that simply have not kept up in their wages. And so those are the families that we're seeing more and more.
So last year we had Hurricane Harvey, who completely flooded the entire city, and the food bank and a lot of other organizations really step up to make sure people are getting what they need during those days. Can you look back and talk to us about the experience you're going through such a catastrophic event?
Yeah, so when you think about what a food bank really is, you know, we're logistics. So we're logistics that works with the voluntary sector, where there's all these volunteer organizations that are willing to help. But it's, you know, our work is logistics. We bring product in, we do whatever we need to do it, we run trucks, and we get it out into 18 counties through all these voluntary partnerships to help people in need. And this is something that food banks realize, and much to his credit, Judge Ed Emmett realized, you know, after Ike, is that, you know, the reality is, you know, the county was setting up its pods for distribution, and they had 30, and we had over 200 churches that went much deeper into the neighborhoods that knew the neighbors and knew what was going on. And his realization, well, why are we running this as a parallel system, as if this voluntary system isn't already there and working well? We just need to repurpose that. And so we really ended up testing that out heavily after Harvey, where because of the very significant level of need, where it was so many households that were devastated or going through the recovery process, you know, the food bank, it was our job to kind of step up to be able to handle the logistics to do many times or many millions of pounds of product. We ended up overall, after Harvey, distributing about $50 million pounds plus worth of product. We had in the first, you know, month and a half, we were distributing about 3 times our normal output. we had, you know, we're running, well, 24 hours a day heavily. We actually are a 24-hour facility 5 days a week, and then on Saturdays and Sundays are shorter shifts as it is, but we don't run full operations 24 hours a day. And we ended up doing full operations where, you know, everybody was either, you know, we're 12-hour shifts and you were either morning or night, and everybody did that. And we did that for weeks on end to try and keep up. But then we also had needed so many volunteers because there's just so much more work to do, and the community responded really well. But then that, you know, that presents its own challenges, because everybody who's walking in, if they haven't been doing this before, they're going to need training. They're going to need direction. We're going to need to be able to solve problems for them. And so we ramped up, and we had a lot of volunteers who also really stepped up as leaders to make that possible. And then, of course, all the partners that we work with, because that's what makes it possible. So that, you know, our role is kind of behind the scenes. It's really all of these voluntary organizations that are out there helping their neighbors in need that made it possible. And we just did that for weeks on end. And then we kind of, you know, slowed it down as we were more dealing with the households that were dealing with long-term recovery issues. This is something that is very often overlooked. People pay a lot of attention after a disaster in, you know, the first couple of weeks, but for households that might have had a $5,000 loss or a larger loss, or in some cases it can actually be a fairly small loss if their resources are very low, it can take a long time for them to recover. And so we try to be there for them throughout that time.
Now that has been over a year, have you noticed that most of those people were able to fully recover, or no, they still need help?
Well, it is very much a mix, and you are correct. Most of the households, you know, have now recovered. And it, you know, varies a lot depending on what their circumstances were before the storm, as well as what happened in the storm. And it's a phenomenon that's actually easy for people to overlook. And, you know, it's actually feasible, or it's actually probably happens a lot, that one household that had a $100,000 loss, you know, even after insurance, et cetera. And this was not uncommon for some of the neighborhoods where the houses were nicer, but they got severely flooded and the property values have dropped so much and all the other expenses, you know, they could easily have had a $100,000 loss even after all insurance payments, et cetera, are done. But in most of those cases, they can actually take the hit. I mean, it's horrible. It is a real loss, but it isn't going to send them into a devastating tailspin. Whereas you might have somebody who they didn't actually get flooded, but they're working their job that they were working in a lower wage hourly job was closed down for a week. And so they had a $400 loss, but that $400 loss could actually, if they had no resources to fall back on, could send them into a tailspin of homelessness and how they're going to take care of their kids that could take them many months to recover from. And so the circumstances are highly varied in terms of, you know, how quickly people are able to recover and where they are right now. And so, which is, you know, why we're still seeing households that are in recovery mode, and it's not because they're just trying to, you know, game the system or something, but their ability to take the hit was so dramatically different than it was for, you know, many people.
Outside the community, private companies and corporations have really stepped up their game to make sure that your organization has everything that you need. But I'm very curious to know about how much the local government is involved in the process.
Well, we try to, you know, mostly for local government, we see ourselves as a resource for them. You know, when, like, for instance, after the storm, when people are calling the city, people come to the county and say, look, I need help. You know, we want to be a place where people can turn. Now, again, for us, it's not that you come here directly, but we have our 1,500 collaborative partners, and so we know who everybody is. We know the neighborhood. You can go on our website and identify, the sites to go on. We even have an app that people can use in order to identify where they can go get assistance. And so that's the main thing, is we coordinate with local government so that we can be a resource, so that we make it easier for them to partner with us and make it so that people can recover quicker. Now, from how do we you know, stay afloat and what our needs are. Well, the number one need is volunteers. It's interesting just when you look at the food waste in the United States and what it's worth, and how easy it is sometimes to turn something that otherwise was headed for the landfill into, you know, high quality, nutritious output to help, you know, families in need. Time is the biggest investment that we have to put into this. And so, which is why we push so heavily to have volunteers, why our facility was designed to handle up to 1,000 people at once. So we could say yes to virtually any size group that says, you know what, we're willing to give 4 hours, or we're willing to give a day, and we'll come in on this evening, or we'll come in on this Sunday, or we'll come in on this Wednesday morning, you know, whatever it is that they can do, when they can do, we want to accommodate them so that we can say yes to all of these opportunities. And actually, you're right, it's actually companies that have become the biggest sources of volunteers for us now, because, you know, so many companies, they see it as a really neat project for their employees to do. It's a good bonding experience for them, and they get to feel good about the output and the help that they're providing the community.
I thought it was very interesting when I read that the conversation has shifted from only feeding people to make sure they are providing a nutritional meal as well.
Yeah, I can say this. It's embarrassing to say this now, but yeah, in the early days, we really saw ourselves as like in the calorie business. You know, we had a naive understanding of hunger. And so we were thinking of, well, hunger is, you know, this, you know, you're lacking food, so any food will do. And we came to realize over time that no, actually the people, the households that we're serving on average have worse health outcomes than the typical American. So if anything, we needed to be more conscious about the nutritional value of what we distribute. And we made, some very significant shifts. Currently, in for Houston Food Bank, over 40% of our distribution is fresh fruits and vegetables now. And when you look at between the canned and frozen on top of it, it's over half of our distribution, which basically, you know, we're now better than the average American diet. If you just consume what we distribute on average. And I think that's important. So there has been a very large shift that way. There's also, we're really working hard on shifting, our work, again, going away from that, what we think is now realizing the more naive assumption that is, oh, so long as we just pass out food, we win, to trying to think about, well, what are the partnerships that we should be doing that will most help people not need us? And how do we put that together? So for instance, some of the collaborations we're doing now with the community colleges and some of the universities, we're pretty excited about, you know, the long-term potential of this. We call it a food scholarship, where the idea is, instead of just saying, oh, if you happen to have an emergency, we're here to give you a little bit of food, we actually make a very significant commitment to the student to provide them in a grocery store type shopping experience, the resources to really provide, you know, take a significant financial burden off them, contingent on their sticking with the program that they're in. And so our goal there isn't just so much hunger today, it is for them to succeed and, you know, to do well and then, you know, not need us in the future. And we're looking at all kinds of different partnerships in the job training area and financial stability area. A lot of health partnerships we're finding a lot of potential in. We're working with like the clinics, the health community, on the wellness activities that they're trying to accomplish and how our resource can help make that happen for low-income population, because essentially their number one target is the same people that we're trying to help, but we had never thought to try and put the two initiatives together. And that's really changing a lot of our thinking.
Share with us a little bit about how the implementation of new procedures and standards and also technology has been able to make food distribution more efficient.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. So it's not like it used to be. I can tell you that. So, start off, you just look in our warehouse and everything's barcoded. The slots are barcoded. They're scanning, with the scan guns on where everything goes. And so the inventory is planned. is we're looking at, well, these are the donated flows that we know we're going to get. What are the things that we're forecasting that we're going to need? And then how the volunteers are registered. I mean, you know, when you think about it, there could be, you know, 600 people coming to volunteer today. We can't have them all standing in line, filling out forms on paper and everything. So, you know, they do that online. They print out a QR code. And so they come in and they just scanned in, and the person just looks at their monitor and says, okay, well, here's where you're going to go for your training so we can, you know, get you productively working as quickly as possible. And then, you know, all the way to the, you know, the truck routes, which, you know, we have all the trucks have GPS, and we optimize schedules and know where the trucks are at any given time and how much longer it's going to be for before their next pickup or delivery to try and keep this all coordinated. So it is utterly different than it was when I started 30 years ago. 30 years ago, I knew how to do everything here. Now I know how to do almost nothing here, but we have really smart, well-trained people who do.
This is a topic that keeps coming up during the podcast, is that as automation, you know, technologies really kind of start tipping away some of the labor force. Do you think that can become a big concern that eventually we're going to have a lot more people needing organizations like yours?
Well, so I really kind of have two answers to that question. The first one is to be blunt about our work. It's deceptive to say, oh, we did more because need went up. It really is not true. The reality is we don't meet need. We didn't meet need 30 years ago. We don't meet need today. So if you're not meeting need, if need changes, it doesn't really directly impact you. I mean, you see what I'm saying? It's like, I wish that wasn't the case, but it doesn't. It's like, look, we're doing the best we can given the resources we have. We're not meeting the need. Now, that's my first answer. Now, the reality is we as a society had better come to grips with the long-term implications of, you know, AI and roboticism, robotics, if you don't own the resources, but instead you basically what you have to offer up is labor, and then you're then essentially then competing with what will become more and more attractive forms of, you know, getting work done. This is going to be very scary for the ability of people to earn a living wage. And as far as we're concerned, okay, do the best we can. All right, we're going to try and help people today. We're going to try and change our strategies so that we can best help people go through training, et cetera, so what they can do to compete. But I think that problem overall is going to be significantly larger than anything you could expect us to deal with. This is going to be a societal level issue to grapple with, is what do we do so that people are able to make a living, even if it's going to be very difficult to say, you know, to compete, say, as a chef with what a robot can do. As a chef, and it's how do we do that? And we might need to start taking a very serious look at something like guaranteed minimum income or something.
Do you think it's inevitable that we're going to have a universal basic income?
This is certainly outside of my food bank expertise. So me as a private citizen, saying I find that, something like that almost inevitable. Probably we will be better off if we start coming to grips with how we might implement that sooner rather than later, because it is going to get scary from an income and wealth distribution standpoint if we go so far where, we want to raise minimum wage, for instance, if you say we want to do this. But the reality is it's going to be harder and harder for a higher minimum wage to compete against what can be done without using a human at all. So it's going to become more and more of a contradiction the more we try and tie that to. Whereas if you were to say, okay, we're going to give you this flat income, but we won't have a minimum wage on top of that. But you're probably, you're going to want to do something. You're not going to just live on the minimum. Almost nobody does. But now that income can be marginal. It can be an additive to your income. A major flaw in the way we currently do our benefits programs is, they scale down if you make money, and which becomes both a disincentive, and it also the wage that you have to offer has to, it can't be simply be additive. So it might be feasible then for that person to, you know, have the cook job or something, because it isn't going to require that you pay them $15. It could just be simply a marginal, you know, wage of say $5 on top of their guaranteed minimum income. And I think it'd be much easier for us to maintain a high employment rate and provide a living wage all around.
It's funny how things work, because you're saying that the biggest challenge for you is volunteering, but if automation and some of this new technology can solve that problem for you, that you could have a system in place that can facilitate that part of the job.
Yeah. So right now, so take truck drivers for, you know, as a, for instance, as you know, everybody is predicting that, you know, eventually, very, you know, very few of these truck driver jobs are going to remain. And right now, probably it's not even a technology question anymore, as much as it's a legal question. You know, how do you handle liability issues, where you're going to blame, you know, the software or the hardware, for the occasional wreck, whereas right now we just, oh, that was that driver. But anyway, so in the meantime, there's a huge trucking shortage or truck driver shortage. And, you know, we're certainly feeling, as I pointed out, we run actually a very large fleet, and, it's so difficult to get truck drivers, but part of the challenge is, you know, people are saying, well, is that really a field I want to go into? Knowing that, you know, this perhaps has a dead end for me. And then, well, how do we adjust to that? You know,
let's go on a positive note now, because outside volunteers, you also have a wonderful group of people who works full time with the organization. So as a leader of such a group, tell me more in terms of what are you looking when you bring somebody on board? What kind of personality, what are you looking in characteristics for someone who wants to work for the food bank?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I used to kind of think of people, well, you know, some people are real mission driven, and, you know, some people, you know, they just, you know, want a good job. Some people want to succeed professionally, and, you know, you kind of have that mix. And it was really interesting. So since we're talking about truck drivers, you know, I could confidently say that the vast majority of the people who come here as a truck driver, they didn't come here because it was like their life dream to work for a food bank. You know, it was a job. And it was a job. Okay, here, you know, our routes are close in. You're going to be able to, you know, come home at night, and, you know, it'll be pleasant. And, you know, these are really nice people to be around. And overwhelmingly, our truck drivers are highly motivated mission people. But I think they become that because of the work, because they're out there seeing the partner charities that are helping people in need, and seeing the families, and going to visit the very generous food companies that help us. And it is incredibly motivational. And so I find that, you know, basically, you know, we want somebody who's got, you know, good skills, good relevant skills. It's not a question of, you know, anybody will do here. But somebody can have a really good attitude, and, you know, do the work and be good to be around. And, you know, we can do the rest, because the ability to generate passion here is kind of like our trump card. it's the go-to that we can always use to smoothen everything else out.
Well, usually before I finish the podcast, I ask my guests to recommend a book, like a personal book that is your favorite, or a book, no, on your area of expertise that you think someone who wants to get involved should read. Do you have one in mind?
Oh my gosh. Oh, so let me just, since we were talking about charitable work and stuff, there's one that I found intriguing called Doing Good Better by William McCaskill. And it challenges people to think about, if they want to have an impact on society, how to think about that in a more constructive way, or a rigorous way. And because you think about, you know, whether you're giving money or giving time, the care that you really should put into thinking about how to make sure that truly is the most impactful thing you can do, and how that can change some of the really big decisions that we make. So that would be the one I would recommend.
Brian, thank you so much for taking the time. Now, do me a big favor and let everybody know who's listening how they can contribute or be involved with the Houston Food Bank.
Sure. Or if you need help or know somebody who does, all will work with HoustonFoodBank.org, and everything falls from that email address.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest, Brian Green. Brian, thank you very much.
It was a real pleasure to hear you. Thank you so.
Hey everyone, make sure to like, comment, and let us know what you think. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.